President Obama called for an increase in the federal minimum wage this week in his State of the Union address. Michigan legislative Democrats, as you've probably heard, have followed up with their own calls for an increase as well. Republicans at all levels say that would be a job killer. Charles Ballard's a professor of economics at Michigan State University and the director of the State of the State Survey, and he joins me in the studio to talk about the debate over the minimum wage and as many other topics as we have time for. Talk fast, Charlie.
Thanks, Mark. Nice to be on the program.
Welcome. This is not a new debate. This topic comes up periodically. If you would, first, sum up the arguments for raising the minimum wage.
The argument for raising the minimum wage is that the current federal minimum at $7.25 an hour, that means that if you work full-time and that's your only source of income, that gets you not quite to $15,000 a year, which if you've got a family of four, that's not enough to get out of poverty. Mm-hmm. So if you raise the minimum wage and if those folks keep their jobs, it helps to reduce poverty. The downside, as has been pointed out, is that we don't know if all those folks will keep their jobs. We know that employers may respond by building new machines to replace the low-skilled, low-wage workers or something. We know that if the wage goes up, there may be some either some folks who lose a job or some folks who are unable to find a job in the first place. And the big debate among economists is how big is that effect? Obviously, if you have millions of folks who have their wage go up and only one person loses his or her job, well, that's a trade-off that most of us would take. Mm-hmm. If only a few people have their wage goes up and there's massive disemployment and unemployment, then that's a trade-off that a lot of us wouldn't take. And so how big is that job loss? My sense is that the, relatively speaking, the increase in the earnings of those who do keep their jobs is likely to be bigger than the job losses. But even that statement is controversial because there are a lot of studies by economists and they don't all reach exactly the same conclusion. One other thing that I would mention about the minimum wage is that it's not targeted at low-income people. It's targeted at low-wage folks. And so at least some of the people who benefit from the higher minimum wage are teenagers in affluent families. In other words, it's not a fairly blunt instrument. If your goal is to reduce poverty, and if some of the people who have a higher minimum wage are kids whose father is a lawyer and mother is a doctor, well, that's not really reducing poverty
right.
very much.
Now, do economists factor that dynamic into their arguments?
Oh, sure.
Generally?
And that's why economists generally are much more favorably disposed toward the earned income tax credit, which is the federal policy that was instituted in 1975 and then expanded under President Reagan, under President Bush, and then under the first Bush, and then under Clinton. And recently, Michigan added an add-on to the earned income tax credit where we top up the federal EITC by 20%. Then last year,
the whole thing got
it was reduced by 70%. So we now top up the federal by only 6%. I'd love to see that go up because that is an anti-poverty program that actually stimulates employment, whereas the minimum wage may lead to some employment losses.
I want to clarify here. I'm not sure I knew this. Michigan's EITC was not completely shelved then.
No, there was talk of getting rid of it entirely, but a compromise was reached, and we still have a much reduced Michigan EITC.
Here with the very familiar argument against raising the minimum wage, this is Wall Street Journal columnist Kim Strassel on Wednesday of this week.
If you demand that the minimum wage goes up, companies are paying that much more every time they hire a worker and for overall costs. And usually what that means for employers is that they don't hire. They do not grow their businesses as businesses that cannot be put into future investment and growth. And so it's overall a bad thing for the economy.
How much weight do you assign to that? I mean, you've come out in, you say the benefits outweigh the costs in the final analysis, but that would be the major cost of raising. Is she right about that?
Oh, I think that's a legitimate argument. I think when business groups talk in terms of they're opposed to it because they wouldn't hire as much and they wouldn't investment as much, I would also add that I think the biggest reason that they don't like it is that they would prefer to get their workers for less, and they would prefer higher profits. But quite apart from that, it is a legitimate argument. We do believe that there are some employment losses, and that's why I give the minimum wage only a C or so, whereas I give the earned income tax credit an A. And if it were up to me, I would have a combination of policies. I'm not against raising the minimum wage. I wouldn't raise it too high, and I would look to other policies to try to improve the lives of low-wage workers, because that is a group that has been hammered in the United States economy in the last 40 years.
$10 an hour too high?
I referred to the controversy among economists. What we know is we have studies based on the data that we have. The bigger the increase, the more uncertain we would be about how large the
impact would be.
If we try it, my guess is that it would be okay, but I'm trying to hedge my bets in terms of that, especially since there are other policies that are so much more effective.
Is this the kind of policy that you see a compromise on? In other words, does it either $10 an hour passes or it goes down, or $8.50, $9 an hour becomes feasible?
I think something like that is very possible. In fact, my guess is that when President Obama put out $9 an hour, he did not expect that would happen.
Right.
He expects that if anything happens, maybe it would be $8. One other thing that the president suggested was tying it to the inflation rate. So, and that would be an interesting change, because what we've had in the past is we wait several years and then we ratchet it up by a substantial amount. Well, what we could do, if you tied it to inflation, then you wouldn't have these big jumps and you wouldn't have it erode a whole lot due to inflation over a long period of time, and then it jumps up, and that sort of a ratcheting it up and down.
We're talking with MSU Professor of Economics Charlie Ballard. There are poverty guidelines that are used for determining eligibility for various programs. But is there some yearly statistic that's calculated that determines how much income a person or family actually needs to pay bills, like some kind of caloric guidelines? You need X calories to live each day. Does the minimum wage bear any resemblance to that?
The minimum wage is not way far from what it would take to get a family of two out of poverty, according to our official poverty. And in fact, the poverty rate that gets quoted, it's a little bit more than $20,000 for a family of four. It came from some calculations 50 years ago or so, where what they did was they said, okay, what's the minimum number of calories that you have to survive and not get sick? And then they made some adjustments to that. So it was that kind of a calculation. And then it's been updated on the basis of inflation ever since. And it's a different number for a family of one, two, three, four, five. For a family of four, it's a little bit more than $20,000. And so the minimum wage is enough to get a family of one out of poverty. It's not enough to get a family of four out of poverty.
I'm always baffled by these discussions of the multiples of the poverty level that always get batted around. How is it 200% of the poverty level or 300% of the poverty level is central to these discussions?
Well, the poverty line is a fairly arbitrary number. And just because you get $1 above the poverty line doesn't mean that you're doing really well in the United States. And so there are a lot of programs, Medicaid is one, where eligibility is conditioned on being some multiple of the poverty line, because there's a desire not just to get to help those who are below the poverty line, but, you know, if you're at 1.2, if you're 120% of the poverty line or 140% of the poverty line, that is still a fairly needy group by modern American standards.
Let's talk for a few minutes about a huge national and international issue right now, and it's austerity versus stimulus. Briefly summarize those different approaches, will you?
Well, we have in much of the world, and certainly in the U.S., we had this catastrophe 4 years ago, this dramatic fiscal financial crisis, which put the economy into a tailspin. And what that was it was a contraction of the private sector. The private sector failed badly because of the banking collapse. Well, when that happens, if the private sector is shrinking, and if nobody steps in to try to offset that, you can make the recession worse. And that's why since the 1930s, when we really figured out some things about this, when economists gained a better understanding of it, since the 1930s, we've understood that if you're in a recession, that federal budget deficits can help to offset the contraction in the private sector. And that's why it was a good thing that we did not rush to try to balance the budget back 4 years ago. If we had done that, we would have made the recession far worse. That's what happened. That's one of the many things that happened in the Great Depression of the 1930s was that they didn't use fiscal policy in an expansionary way as they probably should have. Now, the downside of that is that when you run those deficits, that adds to the national debt.
Right.
And the danger, if you push it too far, is that you become Greece. Now, we are nowhere close to Greece now. Investors all around the world are still happy to buy U.S. government debt. But economists do worry that at some point in the future, these deficits and debt would become unsustainable. And so that's why it's a very delicate balancing act. You want to ease on the brakes over the long period, or else your debt will get out of control. But you don't want to slam on the brakes because that will send the economy into a deeper recession. And so finding the right balance between those competing objectives, that is the great challenge for policy. And it's a very difficult challenge.
I hear that referred to as gas now, brakes later. Is that right?
Yeah, I think certainly I would not want to slam on the brakes now, but we do have to apply the brakes. If we had sensible policy, and of course, getting sensible policy out of Washington is a real challenge. But if we had some sensible policy, what we would do would be to slowly, gradually ease on the brakes over a very long period of time. And we would do other things to try to stabilize the financial system in a way that would mean that we've got an economy that will do okay 10, 20 years from now.
I want to make sure I understand. The case basically for gas now, brakes later is that the economy is just barely percolating along. If we hit the gas now, we would gain more in public revenue over the short term to make the longer term deficit more manageable.
Yes, I think that's a good way to describe it.
Okay.
Yes, because if you slam on the brakes now and put millions of people out of work, well, they're not going to be paying any taxes. And that can actually make your deficit problem worse over the long haul.
Is there a situation acknowledged by economists where austerity has been exactly the policy to follow? Has worked?
Well,
in modern times, anyway.
I guess it depends upon how much austerity you're talking about, because clearly you can't just run infinite budget deficits. But I think that when you look at countries like Greece, like Mexico 20 years ago, like others that have gotten into trouble, they have had unsustainable debt situations. And if nobody's willing to lend to you, then you've got to do something to reduce your deficits. The better policy would be not to get into that situation in the first place. And that's what I hope we can do in the United States, although it remains to be seen.
Peter Coy, in a recent issue of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine, claims that there's a danger involved in thinking of the United States as a family that needs to get its spending under control. And I'm thinking there are enough people who may think this way. I may have thought this way in the past. It might behoove us to explain Coy's thinking on this. Why is it risky, or why might it be risky, to compare the national economy with a spendthrift American family that just needs to cut back?
You hear that analogy a lot, and it's an analogy that has at least some merit, because of course we have to pay our bills at some point. But one big difference between the United States and a household is that the household under the bankruptcy laws, the household has to pay its debts within its lifetime. The United States is going to last for a very, very long time, long after you and I are no longer on this mortal coil. I'm sorry to say that to you, Mark, but it's going to last for a long time. That means that we don't have to pay back the national debt. We could pay some of it down, but there's no requirement that we end at a particular date with zero national debt. We can just roll it over. That's what we've been doing for a long time. We can roll over that national debt and maintain a solid financial system. So in answer to your question, the household is similar to the nation in some ways, but is fundamentally different in other ways. And the other thing is, if the individual household cuts back, it can improve its financial situation. But if the nation cuts back too far, too fast, too hard, then it'll get into a situation where people are laid off, then they can't spend, you know, the barber gets laid off and doesn't have any money to spend at the hardware store, then the hardware store has to lay off some people, then those workers don't have any money to go to the movies, then the movies have to, right, et cetera, et cetera. And so that's how the analogy is very imperfect.
Charles Ballard's a professor of economics at Michigan State University and the director of the State of the State Survey. This has been fun. Thanks for coming in.
You're welcome. Thank you.